So welcome to Research in Pizza, a lunchtime lecture series brought to you by the University of Texas Libraries and featuring research presentations by faculty from across the university and pizza, courtesy of our program supporter, Austin's Pizza. So do make sure you get lots of lunch. Please hold all of your questions until after the presentation because we're recording this for podcasts. And so also, if you do have a question after the presentation, please raise your hand so we can bring the microphone to you so everyone can hear. If you want to learn more about Dr. Beltran's work, we do have some resources here in the library that you can look at. And you can always ask me for help as well. I am the radio, television, and film librarian, Brittany. So do please email me if you have any questions about our resources here today. Do please fill out the feedback form after you're done. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what topics you might be interested in learning more about, and we'll set those up for you. This is everyone that worked on the program, so thank you for that. And let me introduce our speaker today. So we are very lucky to have Dr. Mary Beltran here today. She is an associate professor of radio, television, and film, and an affiliate of the Mexican American and Latino Studies and Women and Gender Studies. Among other topics, she writes and teaches on U.S. Latina and Latino representation and participation in U.S. film and television, on constructions of race, class, gender, and sexuality in film and television, and on negotiations over racial diversity in the media industries. She is the author of Latino Stars in U.S. Eyes, The Making and Meanings of Film and TV Stardom, and co-editor of the anthology Mixed Race Hollywood. She is currently working on a new book on the history of Latina and Latino representation and authorship in U.S. television, titled Bronzing the Box, Latina-Latino Images, Storytelling and Advocacy in U.S. Television. So let's welcome Dr. Beltran.
Thank you very much for being here. And thank you, Brittany, for the invitation. I'm happy to be able to just talk casually about my work with a group of people that I might not always get to encounter and just be able to get your reactions. And what I'll be talking about today is not in any way formally written. I'm going to just be chatting through some of the work that I've done. And Brittany did a really great job of mentioning some of my past work, and I thought I would just say a little bit about the kinds of questions that I like to try to explore. And so the book that I published in 2009 focuses on how Latina and Latino stars were promoted to American audiences, both Latino and non-Latino viewers, from the 20s until more recently. And so looking at how things like the evolving film and TV industries and the shifting demographics of the country and also social shifts in terms of the status of Latinos in the U.S., how that has made a difference in terms of how Latinas and Latinos have been promoted from Rita Moreno, who's actually here on this cover, back when she was about 20 years old in the early 1950s, looking at someone like her all the way through someone like Jessica Alba in recent years. In Mixed Race Hollywood, a piece that I wrote for that, and in some other work that I've done on the Fast and Furious franchise, I also look at this the sort of emphasis lately, as I'll talk about a bit in terms of television, on multicultural ensemble casts in film and TV, with the Fast franchise in film being one of the biggest successes. I look at how mixed race actors are often utilized to play ambiguous, racially ambiguous figures and the kinds of implications that that might have. And also look at how, even though we see some successes financially in the Fast franchise, we actually don't always see that much difference in terms of Hollywood films that get produced. So I basically am trying to often parse out how diversity is being represented today, sometimes in a very utopic fashion that it doesn't have a lot of grounding in real life. And then also I'm looking at how actors of color, producers of color, are often still struggling to have a place within U.S. film and television, and so we have a lot of contradictions. The last three images that are here on the slide on the right are images from my latest book project that Brittany mentioned, Bronzing the Box. And it's a history of Latinos in U.S. television, going back to the 50s until today. And hopefully in the next year, I'll be able to finish that project. And so I do have a number of kind of irons in the fire. And so today, I'm going to bring up a topic to this group. I'm going to talk about what's been talked about is this new diversity in television and how we can try to understand it and really have a sense of the implications of new shows like Atlanta or Empire or Fresh Off the Boat. And then also things that don't change that quickly, like the SNL cast, which just recently added some African-American women. And you may know that there was a Latina for the very first time after 40 years was added to the cast in the last year, Melissa Villaseñor, but she hasn't really had a lot of opportunity on the show. And so there, in terms of an answer to this question, basically, it's going to be yes, no, and sort of, and not quite, and there are a lot of different answers. In my research on the question of new racial diversity in television, I typically am going back to the early 2000s, and that's looking at sometimes at films, but also looking at these new multi-ethnic ensemble shows. The Walking Dead is a more recent version, but The Walking Dead has antecedents in things like Lost, and shows like Glee, shows like Heroes. And really, actually, let me go one more slide, because Lost, I would say, is very much was the first major influential show that featured a multi-ethnic and actually multinational cast. Now, one thing that was really unique, and I think it made a difference in this show, in some ways, representing diversity in a more substantial way than we usually see, is that they actually were able to cast the show at times by simply choosing actors and creating roles for them. And that's very, very unique. Like usually TV writers, if they want to get a pilot, they almost always actually have to create the characters and sell the script and then get funding and then cast. And the typical casting process usually is at the disadvantage of actors of color. Because unless roles are specified as being for a character of color, almost always, actors aren't always invited to audition in a colorblind fashion. And so more often it's like if you're an African-American female actor, unless the role is a sassy best friend, you may not get to audition. You may not really be considered to audition for the protagonist role who is, you know, the main female character, the ingenue, what have you. But in this case, J.J. Abrams had just done Alias, I believe, that was really successful. And so based on his name as a showrunner who was proven, they let them rush through the process of auditioning. And so as a result, they cast people like Jorge Reyes, who played Hurley, and Yoon-jin Kim, who played Sun. And they actually initially thought of casting Yoon-jin Kim as the character of Kate, that was played by Evangeline Lilly. She was sort of the main female character as the story went on. And they even played with the idea of killing off the doctor, Jack. You might remember Matthew Fox's character of Jack, who in a way becomes the kind of the main lead character. They were gonna kill him off at the end of the pilot. They were gonna have him, like something was gonna happen, he was gonna die. And so they wanted to actually do things differently in storytelling by making people think it was gonna be the usual kind of American television show where the white guy is always the lead and then like throw that into chaos. And then Kate was gonna become their leader. So they were perfectly happy to have a Korean woman play that main character. And they showed it to audiences and apparently the viewers didn't want that. They didn't like thinking that Jack was the lead and then finding out he died. So they kind of chickened out, but they did do some things that were different that I think meant that they had a more interesting, compelling, diverse cast. What I find in my other work, like if we go back to shows like Heroes and Glee, is that less often that happens. More often instead, we begin to see over time that those characters of color often don't get the development that we might expect them to get. And quite often instead, white characters become the main characters. and these other characters are more minor. So we begin to see these patterns in the 2000s to the point where now it sets the stage for someone like Shonda Rhimes, an African-American female showrunner and writer, to be able to create shows that also had multi-ethnic casts and that often deliberately did not call attention to race. And so a scholar by the name of Kristen Warner, who's done work on Shonda Rhimes, talks about this as not just colorblind casting, but blind casting in terms of also ignoring race within the script. And it was a very successful formula, as you know. Like, she first had Grey's Anatomy. We see the cast here. Later, she has Scandal and Murder, She Wrote. And is that right? Murder? Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, that sounds wrong. That sounds like an older show. Yes. Not Murder, She Wrote. And so we can begin to ask questions, too, about what it means to ignore race within the scripts. Is that certainly at times I think it can be very progressive in terms of perhaps not stereotyping, not making characters of color substantially different from other characters. But at the same time, sometimes it also ignores the fact that race, our cultural identities do affect our lives at times and how we interact with others. And so it can really deny some of those realities at the same time. Of course, it can make us feel good about ourselves if we watch these shows, because it can make us feel like we're very post-racial and that race doesn't matter in real life. And so I think there's something comforting about that as well. And it's probably no surprise that these are shows that are on the broadcast networks and they get sometimes the largest audiences. This is a quote that was in the Kristen Warner reading in 2016 that Shonda Rhimes has talked in interviews that it's important that characters who had interracial relationships in the show never seem to call attention to race at all. Like, it never, ever matters. It doesn't matter to their families. There's almost like racism just doesn't exist in these worlds. And so, again, that can be, I think, comforting. And so Warner ends up, I would agree with her, that there's something about it that ultimately is kind of anti-political or anti-reality, that it makes race just about skin color, and it's a way to sort of show this PC kind of aesthetic that a series has, a sort of rainbow of actors who never have to worry about race. But there are some changes in more recent shows, obviously, and I think it's important to think about that. Now, one thing that was happening, too, in the 70s, there were shows that were very race and ethnic specific. So there's shows like Good Times and Sanford and Son and even Chico and the Man, although it did a poor job really addressing race. But what happens by the 80s and then the 90s is that the networks and advertisers want to turn away from that. And they really want, they feel like that's too political. Advertisers seem to feel like, at least at that time, that it might turn people off of thinking about purchasing products, which is really why they want to buy time. They want us to think about admiring the objects within shows and a consumer sort of mentality, and it seems like any kind of social consciousness might take away from that. So shows like this actually manage to do everything. They can still kind of not really call attention to race while making us feel like we're not racist and we're not white-centric and so on. So the kinds of things that I encourage students to ask when they look at these kinds of shows, to try to think about how well they're actually showing ethnic diversity and cultural differences, is to think about the various characters. And it's what could be called a narrative analysis. Whose stories are being told? And not only that, but which characters get more development than others? Like, we are subtly, we may feel like we're getting everybody's story, especially in an ensemble cast show that's maybe like a cop drama or a hospital drama. But at the same time, there's some characters that definitely get a certain kind of development that others don't get. In particular, like, there's some characters who we get to follow back to their homes. Maybe it's a workplace drama. So some characters, we learn about their home life. We learn about their romantic angst. We learn about different things, and other characters never get that. And so they become kind of a window dressing of political correctness, perhaps, that that may fool us into thinking we're really seeing a very culturally diverse show. So, you know, I think Lost did a better job than some shows because they had the flashback sequences that took us into the lives of most of the characters, but some more than others. Glee really didn't do a good job of fleshing out a few of their characters, characters of color. Friday Night Lights was interesting. And one thing I also ask is to think about the setting in which a story takes place and the kind of natural diversity that exists there. And Friday Night Lights in a central Texas small town almost never showed Latino people, Mexican-American characters. I would think a football team would have guys of that were Mexican-American as well as Anglo. They initially didn't showcase any African-Americans until the season that was set in the school that was mostly African-American. So it was a strange thing to me that they didn't capitalize on that natural diversity that we have here in Texas. So we can think about that, and we can think about, you know, who really are we meant to identify with? And then finally, I think it's very important to look at who's writing, who's producing and directing shows. And at the same time as we've had this uptick in multicultural ensemble cast dramas, we've actually had the numbers of writers of color decrease. And so when I've done interviews with the Writers Guild, it's been interesting to learn that. We are seeing some improvement in that just in the last couple of years. You're probably aware of shows now that have showrunners of color like Aziz Ansari and Donald Glover. But they're still are really pretty few and far between. So what can look like this vast amount of diversity on television now doesn't always really add up to that. A term that I find useful that a scholar by the name of Dale Howard came up with is multicultural whiteness. And it's an interesting thing because it's like a show like Glee, I think, really embodies this sort of concept, this idea that we're still seeing this, it's kind of a more diverse whiteness. We're not necessarily seeing different cultural communities. You know, the main milieu of parents, of teachers, you know, is still really pretty white-centric. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're seeing what we saw on Good Times or a show like South Central that was on television in the 1990s in terms of an African-American neighborhood and issues and struggles. So I don't know. And then we have new shows now, and I do think that it brings up new questions as we're seeing television viewing really shift. The fragmentation of the audience, I think, is something that researchers looking at this stuff need to keep in mind quite a bit. You know, nowadays, we're not all watching broadcast TV. We don't all have TV sets. Some people are only watching Netflix TV shows and Hulu and Amazon. They don't keep ratings in the same way that the Nielsens are watching who watches broadcast television. And so it's going to really be important, I think, to begin to gather more information about, you know, which audiences are watching what, when or if they overlap. Now that we're seeing our country divided very much politically, I actually think the television viewing is just one part of the kind of political, social identity that we may now have. And how we view diversity or the importance of diversity, I think, is a big part of that. So what we watch is probably going to reaffirm the way we view diversity in the United States. So we may watch things that make us feel like ethnic groups are really divided and at war, or we may watch things that make us feel like people of all different backgrounds have nuanced lives and issues. And so if we're choosing to watch Atlanta, you know, which is the image that we have on the top, you know, we may not be the same audience that's watching CSI with a mostly very white-centric kind of story world. And So yes, there is more diversity in some ways, but I don't. But it's kind of a fragmented diversity exists in this one area of television and not in other areas. And I think time will still tell whether there will be the same kind of status and power in having a very successful show on Netflix versus having a very successful show on NBC. So it's still kind of up in the air. It is helpful, I think it makes a difference that a show like Atlanta is getting attention from critics as well as popular attention. Recently, I was able to be part of the judging team for the Peabody Awards, which awards excellence in television every year. And I'm almost positive that Atlanta is going to get a pretty major recognition from the Peabodys. But there's just a lot of complexity to all of us to think about the true impact. There are some shows that are really exciting and presenting very new, diverse viewpoints that are also streaming and available just on YouTube. And if you know to find them, they're there. But often those are shows that have had to look for crowdfunding or other kinds of outside funding. And many of them end after one season or two seasons because they can't sustain themselves financially. So that's another thing as well. And I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see. It was just a few years ago, just as soon as like 2011, a lot of these shows that now are touted as the new diverse shows, a lot of them didn't exist. And so I'm hoping that we're kind of on an upturn and it's not just going to be a temporary trend. But I do think that we're going to need to keep asking these questions. This is some of the research. There have been studies that are done from time to time on ethnic diversity behind the camera. And so in this case, it was episodic television. And so you can see by gender that women are still very underrepresented as TV directors. And for directors of color also, they're only 18% of all working TV directors when, I think that whites are, white Americans are about 60% of the population now. And so that number also is definitely underrepresentation. So that's not changing too dramatically. And sometimes I'm also looking at the efforts of the networks and specific shows to attempt to improve diversity on camera and also behind the scenes. SNL has gotten some flack over the years because they haven't always been very ethnically diverse. I think the one reason why I bring it in is because I know that part of their job is to represent the important sort of movers and shakers in society. And so if you have no Latino cast members, I guess that's kind of symbolizes this idea that maybe Latinos just don't matter at that level of decision making or celebrity culture and so on. Now we've had, I think a number of African-American women have been added and a few African-American men. After the show was criticized for having Fred Armisen play Barack Obama, those kinds of decisions. But still, it's an interesting show to scrutinize in terms of diversity. And then I'm just going to end with this slide, and I'd like to just open it up for discussion. I bring in this slide by Ava DuVernay, who's a very successful filmmaker, who also recently moved to television and decided with her series, Queen Sugar, I think is the name of it, that all of the directors would be women. And many of them are women of color, but that had never been done in television before. One reason why I bring this in is that the efforts of the TV networks in the past used to always be described under the buzzword of diversity. It would be like the vice president of diversity is the title that they would have at every network as the one person who was supposed to try to spearhead efforts to change things, to initiate different kinds of programs and initiatives that might bring in actors of color and writers and directors of color and so on. And they're gradually beginning to turn away from using just the word diversity to bring in the word inclusion, as Ava DuVernay mentions here, because diversity can really amount to that kind of sprinkling of people with darker skin in with what they typically would expect, and not necessarily including voices, including stories, including authors, by people of groups that have not been represented much in the media. And so it's going to be interesting to see how things will be shifting. I think also Oscars So White put a lot of attention on the film community and the lack of sustained inclusion of diverse voices in film. And I think that's also making people think about television as well. And so time will tell really where we're going, but it's been really an interesting project to be focused on. So thank you.
We're going to open this up to questions. Does anyone have a question? Just raise your hand.
Hi. One of the things I noticed on Friday Night Lights was that the Latino characters tended to be either like troublemakers or like reforming criminals.
Yeah.
So I was curious if you think that representations of Latino characters on TV shows now are sort of breaking those stereotypes or challenging those stereotypes.
That's a good question. You know, I think that it's been a bit sad to see some of the ways in which Latinos have been represented on television in the last 15 years or so. I mean, we've had shows like Weeds and Breaking Bad that featured Latino drug-related criminals and who've been seen as kind of the most violent of the violent characters. But at the same time, we're seeing some progress. It seems to be more for women than for men. So we have characters in Jane the Virgin, you know, you have a young woman and her mother and her grandmother, all very different kinds of characters and very nuanced that are presented in Jane the Virgin. Ugly Betty there were some problematic things in Ugly Betty, but also I think for the most part, it was remarkable to have a Latina lead character who had a lot of admirable qualities, often compared to people who were not so great. Who were the ugly characters, but I don't see many Latino men represented as protagonists, represented in a very nuanced way so far. Yeah.
Any other questions?
I guess. What are your thoughts on, like, shows that are very like ethnic specific, like One Day at a Time? You know, in terms of, like, if they exaggerate some of these, like, stereotypes, you know, in order to kind of, like, get your point across, like, do you feel that it's progressive in the sense that, you know, they're representing these cultures or they're just stereotyping them and capitalizing on them?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it depends. You know, I expected to not... when I began to watch the new One Day at a Time, I was expecting not to like it and was surprised at liking it for the most part. And I think that past examples of those kinds of shows, especially if you go all the way back to like the 1980s and 1990s, they were often really actually creating new stereotypes. And they tended to be, multi-camera sitcoms. And there were shows like a show called A.K.A. Pablo that starred Paul Rodriguez, who was a comedian in the 1980s. And his character was a comedian, and he lived with his extended family. So there were like 8 or 9 different characters, all kind of crazy Latinos of different kinds. And it was always noisy and very, very colorful. And I think ultimately it didn't work and was almost offensive in a way, and that it was sort of recreating these kinds of stereotypes. And one of the major problems with a lot of those early shows is that they had no Latino writers. So they were typically written by, you know, white American writers based on what they thought Latinos were like. And that was the case also often in the writing of African-American characters and so on, until actually fairly recently. And so I think that the more recent shows like One Day at a Time and Atlanta and Master of None, Aziz Ansari's show, these are shows that have writers who are bringing in their own experience and their own stories. And I think it really goes a long way to making these, you know, they're not trying to create perfect characters either, as some writers of color actually were doing in the 1990s and early 2000s. So often, instead, we're seeing nuanced, sometimes flawed characters just like us. And I think that they tend to present different cultures in a much more sympathetic and nuanced and actually interesting way. So I do think there's some differences, but yeah, I think it really involves looking at a show in depth to learn more about it. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Hi, I was wondering if there is any data on enrollment by women or people of color in RTF programs, and if it has any correlation with the slide that you were showing about the number of or percentage of women or people of color who are serving as TV directors now.
That's a great question. I actually don't know if there is anything, but I can look that up, and I'd be happy to let you know at some other time. I know that here at UT Austin that we have, I think that the class is almost 50-50 in terms of gender, although I have noticed that the young women in our department who are on a production track, a lot of them shift over from deciding in the very beginning that they want to be directors to instead deciding maybe they'll work as editors. And I think that that's something that happens in film schools all around the country, that sometimes, unless I think there are more women faculty and teaching assistants and so on who really encourage all of the students to work together in an equitable way on their film crews, that sometimes sort of gender norms will sometimes mean that the guys will take a much more assertive sort of role, and that sometimes young women in the classes sometimes begin to feel a little bit like they're being pushed to the side. So I think that happens. I know also that UT Austin has a really great percentage of Latino students, and I think the only other film schools that would have as many would be USC and UCLA. Sometimes in other parts of the country, film schools are fairly white dominated still. And so in some research that I've done on initiatives in Los Angeles, we've talked, you know, in talking to people at studios and networks, they sometimes talk about the need for outreach to high schools to really encourage high school students to think of media production and writing for media as a career path. And maybe even grade school would be a place to start. Because it does make a difference, I think, if kids' families encourage them to consider that as a career, but also if their schools make it seem like it's a possibility. Yeah.
Okay, we have one more question, and then we'll have to wrap up.
So I've seen an uptick in cultural sensitivity editors. Are you seeing that happen in TV and film? There are publications, publishers that are having these editors read for cultural sensitivities. Do you see any of that?
Huh. I think it's, I mean, one thing that I've seen some increase of is bringing in consultants on a show that it's meant to represent a specific ethnic or cultural group that in the past they might, I could say like in the 1970s with the show Chico and the Man, there was someone hired who had been a Latino media advocate, and he was really hired more as a kind of window dressing of the supposed PC credentials of the producers who were all white, and then he wasn't really taken seriously, or he wasn't really utilized on the show, whereas now I think sometimes we see an actual thoughtful engagement of a consultant in that fashion. But you know, I think it's wildly diverging just depending on who the showrunner is. And there are some showrunners who care about that and some who just really just want to have a show that can make money. And you know, really, I mean, the studios and the networks are still very focused on profit. But they don't want boycotts and they don't want protests. But also audiences don't tend to do that as much as they used to. So I'm not sure if it's happening as much What field are you in?
I'm a librarian.
You're a librarian.
Biosciences. So I've seen publishers are using these editors as a PC control kind of thing, right? Is to mitigate some of the issues they may have with a manuscript based on cultural issues. So I was just wondering if that's rolling over into the film or TV industry.
Yeah. There are ethnic media advocacy groups that are, they're ethnic specific. So there's the National Hispanic Media Coalition, and there's another group that focuses on Asian American representation and so on. And sometimes a production will hire, in a way, like they will enlist the service of that group and ask them to like be a focus group for them and offer feedback. Although they typically tend to be very careful about giving too much leeway to another group to judge. But at the same time, they don't want that group to protest when the show is on the air. So I think they're trying to kind of cut off any criticism before before the show happens. And they do use test audiences quite often, but that's usually very closely guarded information that they don't share with the public at all.
It seems a little bit late in the process, too, that they're writing scripts and have intended characters where we're seeing, Latin characters are always playing the criminal, right? How can you ward that off before it even gets to the pilot stage or the testing stage?
Right. Yeah, so it depends on individual writers and producers if that's important to them.
All right, let's give Dr. Beltran a round of applause and thank her for coming
out
today. Thank you so much. If you want to learn more about Dr. Beltran's work, I do have a recommended reading list if you want to email me or email Dr. Beltran. And we'd also like to thank the owner of Austin's Pizza, JD, is in the back. So thank him for lunch today. He's been donating pizza for this program since, 2011. So big round of applause for free lunch, guys. And please fill out the form on your seat if you have a chance and let us know if you have any ideas for this program or any other library services. Thank you.